Captain Barrow, Reel 4. I think you'd like to say something about what went on back in the United Kingdom.
Yes, I think that often in wartime, the part played by the people left at home is forgotten. And I think these can break down into two categories. One are the people who have duties to do in support of the war or operations going on elsewhere, and the other is the families themselves. As regards the former, the staffs, the support, and all that sort of thing that we received, I could not have wished for better, right from the top downwards. The command set up that we had with a determined Prime Minister, a fantastically good and well-known to me Chief of the Defence Staff in Admiral Lewin, my own Commander-in-Chief, Admiral Fieldhouse, and finally in my chain of command, the Chief of Staff there, David Halifax, another old friend of mine, and Sandy Woodward himself. I couldn't have wished for better military directives, which is all you need if you're a commanding officer at sea, political resolve leading to good military directives, clearly understood rules of engagement. That's not to say we didn't have a few hassles every now and again with the Admiral, but at the end of the day, very clear directives and firm orders to carry out those directives. I couldn't have wished for better. Likewise, on the logistics side, when we asked for things we really needed, everybody bent over backwards to do what they could to get them to us, either from within the task group or, if that wasn't possible, from UK or elsewhere. As far as the families at home are concerned, I think a lot was learnt in the course of the Falklands campaign. The Navy has already always had a welfare service to cope and catch the unfortunate families who get themselves into trouble for whatever reason under normal peacetime circumstances, but hasn't really ever hoisted in, not since World War II anyway, until 1982, the effect on families of having their husbands, brothers or whatever, sons, away doing something operational. I've always thought that the Army was very much better at this. They have the regimental system where the regiment or the corps or whatever it is look after the families as a unit. In the Navy it's different. Families live all over the UK and no real organisation has ever existed other than to tell families if people are lost or injured. In this case, I was extremely lucky in that I don't know why, but I left with my wife a telephone number list of all my officers in the ship before I went off. I'd never done this before, and maybe it was some sort of premonition of which I was unaware at the time, but by using that list of telephone numbers, and I later got her an address list also of all the people on board, she was able to form little support groups all around the country of like-minded, usually wives, but sometimes fathers or mothers of the ship's company, and developed a very good sort of network of information in both directions, which was, I think, a great support, mutual support, to all the people, mostly wives, but others as well, concerned. Mostly, of course, we were unaware of what was going on until we started getting mail. But the other thing that we developed from Glamorgan, and it became a widely accepted fleet practice after the Falklands campaign, was what we call family grams, where usually the commander and I, between us, put together a few words, not more than a couple of hundred words, into a signal which we sneaked into the system. Ours actually went through the chaplain of HMS Mercury, because that was near to where my wife lived. He gave the message to my wife, and this formed the basis of the next mail-out from her organisation to the various key points around the country. And by doing that, we kept people together. And I think the proof of that has probably been in the succeeding 10 years or so, when a lot of those people who met through their men folk being in the Glamorgan have actually remained firm friends. And when we have our reunions now, which we do every 5 years or so, they greet each other like like long-lost friends, oh yes, I remember you were the man who ran the newsletter from Hull or rang me up about something or other. And this has worked well. The fleet has learnt by it. I'm not saying we were the only ship to do it in the Falklands, but I think we were certainly the first. And since then, a lot of other units have followed suit. By dint of this, I think the families were kept much better informed than it was ever possible to do by what I call official means, and they were reassured, if only in the knowledge that other people were feeling the same as they were at the same time and longing for news.
We hear a great deal nowadays about this so-called counselling and the necessity, so-called necessity for it for psychological casualties. Did any of your complement show after the Exocet hit any mental derangement because of it?
Well, I'll dodge your question first of all by saying that on the way down to the Falklands, I did have one case, a senior rating in a responsible position, who definitely showed signs of going round the bend. My doctor, who was a young, extremely good, but very young and very inexperienced, was all for landing this man at Ascension on the way down. I took the risk, and I realise now that it really was a risk, that we could sort him out if we kept him on board, because I felt if we put him ashore, there might well be others who thought that they were going to go the same way and would also ask to go ashore. The Chinese laundry crew were the only people who actually asked to be offloaded, and I was at pains to make sure that that was not possible because I wanted our laundry to continue throughout the campaign, and in fact they settled in very well. There was no problem. As far as after the casualty had been sustained, I think immediately after, like all disasters, that tends to bind people together, and the corporate entity of the ship was never greater than that sad occasion I related on the evening of the 12th of June when we buried them. But I suspect that about a week or something like a week afterwards, there were people who were pretty down in the dumps. Fortunately, that only lasted for a very short time, because quite soon after that, we got a large whack of mail, which included all those fruit cakes that people made for us in UK, but never actually reached us till it was all over. And shortly after that, again, we were on our way home to UK. Since the event, I know of two men who have had, loosely described, mental problems. Neither was serious, and I suspect that all of us are the wiser for having been embroiled in Operation Corporate, and probably none the worse for it.
So that chap who showed those mental signs as you were going down, was that because he was terrified as to what was going to happen?
Yes, he was a man who worked, he was a senior rating, he worked down in the Sea Slug magazine, very often on his own, as I said, in a very key position, and I think he was thinking too much about what might happen. He did also have a rather disturbed family set up, and I think the combination got the better of him for a very short time, but he recovered in a few days and in fact played a very significant part later in keeping things going well.
Did you learn anything about yourself from having taken part in it?
The short answer is yes. I was very glad to have taken part in it. Nobody likes going to war, and least of all shooting at other people. But at the end of 37 years' career, in which I'd really hardly fired a shot in anger, except very minor conflicts like the Cod War or confrontation in Malaya, that sort of thing, I was very glad to be able to put into practice not only what I had learnt and my experience of that 37 years, but also it was very satisfying to see how a ship's company, who I'd really worked up for 18 months by then, reacted to the training that they and I had received in what I considered, and I was delighted when the Commander-in-Chief confirmed it, his satisfaction, so very satisfactorily.